Hi, I'm Will Ruger of the Charles Koch Institute, and I'm joined by Jason Sorens from St. Anselm College, and we're here with Governor Chris Sununu to talk about freedom in the 50 states and to talk about New Hampshire's number one ranking. So we're happy to have everyone join us, and thank you, Governor, for joining us.
Well, thanks for ranking us number one.
Well, we're excited to talk about freedom here. And in our book, we define freedom as the ability to use your life, liberty, and property as you see fit, consistent with the equal rights of others, of course. And what we do in this book, Freedom in the 50 States, is we look at over 200 state and local policy variables. And these are in the areas of fiscal policy, regulatory policy, and personal freedom areas. And we look at these and we weight them based upon the cost of the people who would enjoy them. And then we rank the states. So Jason, why don't you tell us just briefly, what are the five worst states in terms of the least amount of freedom? And again, we're not talking about Burma or, the Congo in terms of their level of freedom, but within the American system, who are the worst states?
Yeah, so we find that New York, every time we've done this, all six editions, New York has been number 50, and it still pulls up the rear this time. Hawaii's 49, California's 48, New Jersey's 47, and Oregon is 46. So those are our bottom five.
Okay, so what are the best ones? We've already kind of like let the cat out of the bag here, yeah. but what are the states that are right behind New Hampshire, starting with number five?
So number five is South Dakota, a fairly free state. Tennessee's number four, Nevada's number three, Florida's number two, was number one the last time we did this study, and New Hampshire, which was number two last time we did the study, is now number one. So Florida and New Hampshire have been switching off the last few editions, both very free states. And what's interesting is that every time we've done this, going back over a decade, we've looked at the data and we've seen how freedom matters to Americans. And we find that Americans are moving from less free to freer states, controlling for everything else, climate and so on. And states with more economic freedom grow faster, have faster personal income growth. So freedom does matter, makes a difference to states.
So before we move to the governor here, could you tell us, because again, we were joking beforehand about how there's some very small weighted variables. When you have 200 plus variables, you're going to have a lot of things. But what are some of the big ones, right, in the fiscal, regulatory, and personal freedom policies, the ones that are really having the biggest impact on people's freedom?
Well, taxation is really a very big one. And we look at state and local taxation differently and actually give states a little bit of credit if they have more choice of local government. So it's easier to move from one local government to another. But we have state and local taxes. Those are very big. We look at business regulations, especially things like land use regulation that drives up the cost of housing. That is a really big one because of the research showing how important that is. Labor regulation like minimum wage, right to work, those are important. And on the personal freedom side, we look at things like incarceration rates, adjusting for crime rates. And we look at a whole range, again, 230 different policies, a whole range of variables there. But those are some of the really big ones that feed into the study.
Well, great. Well, thanks. Let's talk to the governor here. So, Jason, I think you were going to ask the first question just about New Hampshire topping the rankings. So why don't you go ahead?
Yeah. So congratulations on New Hampshire topping the rankings this time. We were just talking about how you got elected in 2016 and the state was number two then, and now it's number one. So why do you think it is that New Hampshire is the freest state in the country? Is it the people of New Hampshire, the culture, something about the government and institutions? What's your explanation?
It's a little bit of all that. I think you can sum it up with local control. We have not just a tradition, but a very long history of local control in that our town meetings matter. We have very high participation rates when it comes to public service, whether it's at your town level or being one of the 400 members of our legislature. And when you have one of the largest parliamentary bodies in the free world with 400 members representing only 1.4 million people, by definition, even at the state level, it's the most one of the most representative bodies of government in the world, which means the control is really at the individual level, right? So it goes back to that concept of local control. And when you have more local control, an individual citizen has much more say on how their taxes are spent or what's going on in their schools or whether that pothole is going to get filled or not. And it's that sense of that is, in its essence, taking on that responsibility. I have a responsibility to myself, my family, my community, and my voice can be heard and actually has some weight to it. So because of that, I think there is an inherent sense of freedom. There's an inherent sense of this isn't in the government's hands. It isn't a one-size-fits-all government solution to come down. It really is about my job as governor is to open up doors of opportunity. Mm-hmm. But let the individuals decide whether they want to go through those doors or not. And let the most powerful debates on education and all of that to really happen at that local level where you can get the teachers involved and the real policymakers involved and the ones that can drive better results, not from the government level, but what's mm-hmm. happening in the classroom or what's happening in your town. Because those are the things that affect us every single day. A lot of, I think, for many years, many states had that concept and philosophy in the 1800s and early 1900s, and a lot of states really pushed hard to get away from that. Right. And that's pushing away from checks and balances in many ways. That's pushing away from where you can just simply get the best results and where I think government can be most efficient. It's most efficient when it's a wide open door for the individual. So it's a little bit of a sense of freedom. You could go all the way back and say it's part of our Puritan days, right? Back in New England and all of that. We kind of broke off from, they were burning witches down in Massachusetts. So we kind of broke off from that a little bit. Some people think New Englanders and folks specifically in New Hampshire, well, they can be a little bit rude. No, we're about ourselves. We take care of our own communities and feel very passionately about that. And we spend a lot of time with that responsibility. And so in that is, I think, the essence of why New Hampshire is traditionally on top of the freedom charts. And the government has to respond to that. I mean, we could go pass laws with more taxes and all this sort of thing, but we have to respond to the needs of the people because they have such a voice. I respect that. And that's why I think, we not only do we maintain that level of freedom, but there is that checks and balances on the government to make sure it never, gets too far afield. Number two is pretty far afield. If we're ranked second in the country, we take personal offense to that. So we want to read the book, challenge ourselves, and get back to number one. And we were able to do it in the past few years, which is an honor.
Yeah. So, people talk about the New Hampshire advantage.
Yes.
And do you think it's because the citizens of New Hampshire have kind of internalized that this is something that is helpful for them? I mean, they love freedom. Mm. I've been up there a lot. We know that. Yeah. But it seems like that New Hampshire advantage is something because the other states of New England just aren't doing as well. I mean, you're a really different state than your neighbors. So it's not a regional effect. So tell us about how people think about this New Hampshire advantage. I mean, business owners.
Yeah. People have to remember we have 30 minutes south of us is Cambridge, Massachusetts, communist central, frankly. Just to the west of us is Vermont and Bernie Sanders. Anytime he gets too close to the New Hampshire border, we have alarms that go off on our watches. We have Quebec to our north, a great Canadian partners, but very socialistic to the north. And then Maine, obviously. So we are surrounded on all sides. And you go beyond that, you get to New York and Connecticut and New Jersey, it really starts getting ugly in terms of the list and restrictions of freedoms. I think a lot of folks think, oh, well, New Hampshire is just a semi-blue state. No, it's not. We really are a purple state, right? Because we hold those values so true. So I think, the New Hampshire advantage is really about no sales tax, no income tax, and pretty soon no interest and dividends tax. So you should think about moving there. I got rid of that this past year. It's rolling down to zero. But it's not just, I think to your point, it's not just about having low taxes. Good fundamentals around your fiscal discipline is the cornerstone of opportunity for everything else. And I think because that New Hampshire advantage is built around strong fiscal discipline from a government level, it allows opportunity for individuals. And that's why we set ourselves apart. It's so easy for governments, we talk about it and you guys get it. Well, it will just be a 1% income tax today, and then it goes to 5 or 6%. We never let that door crack. I was shocked. I honestly was shocked. Even Democrats in New Hampshire proposed an income tax. And I thought, this is the death nail. And it really was. We were the only state to flip our House and Senate from Democrat to Republican in 2020, primarily because the Democrats ignored the New Hampshire advantage. They ignored that fundamental cornerstone, that essence of freedom, which is low taxation, which ultimately leads to less government intervention into your lives.
Yeah, and Milton Friedman talked about the importance of economic freedom to overall freedom. You can't be a place that doesn't have economic freedom and be considered free. And so, but the last time you joined us here at Cato, where we are today, you discussed the number one ranking in your fiscal policy report card. on America's governors. So congratulations on that. That's very much related to you. And congratulations again on this metric. But what has been going on in New Hampshire since you last came to Cato? I mean, what have you been doing personally to advance freedom? But let's remember that we have, you know, not just an executive branch, but the legislature. How has the legislature been working in New Hampshire to increase freedom?
Well, obviously, I mean, in the past couple of years, everything's gone a little bit haywire across the country. Everything from attitude to what you're seeing nationally and you know, happen here in Washington, D.C. And most importantly, I think what you're seeing in the states, and I maybe I'm saying this because I'm biased as a governor, but, you know, if we can take a pause on and talk about the pandemic for a minute, when you're talking about what happened with COVID, in those, especially in 2020, it was the governors, both Republican and Democrat, frankly, that had to stand up and say, okay, we've been given flexibility by the former Trump administration, which was very powerful and very much appreciated by all 50 governors. The CARES Act money came out, whatever it was. But then we had flexibility to design systems that really empowered us for our citizens. It wasn't a one size fits all. And that was a refreshing note out of Washington, D.C. at the time, in a time when it was most needed. But since then, I mean, maybe it was because, you know, last time I was here, I had lowered some taxes and we got this great favorable rating for being very fiscally responsible. I cut more taxes. That was the first thing, right? Because we could. And the model has borne out. It works. Mm-hmm. We have business taxes in New Hampshire. We had an interest and dividends tax and we had a few others. When we lowered them, people said, oh, wait, there's more economic freedom there. I might have more flexibility for my families. So businesses started to come there and grow there and make investments. And what happens? Our revenues actually went up, right? Because it's long-term sustainable. So the revenues actually go up when we cut taxes. So we did it again and again. This year, our revenue numbers are through the roof. They're absolutely through the roof. So the challenge for us is to say, how do we return it? We returned $100 million. You know, legislature said, okay, $100 million off the statewide property tax. Boom, done. Like, just give people property tax relief. Let's send them cash back. When the CARES Act money came, very proud of the fact that we didn't use all that CARES Act money, as like many other states did, just to do government stuff. We created a $400 million a Main Street relief fund for small businesses. Let's give them the money. Mm-hmm. And we did that in 30 days. From the day I announced it to the day the first checks went out, 30 days. And we created a program, created an application, sent, I think, $350 million out the first time, another $50 million out the second. We did it for nonprofits because they're employers. We did it for self-employed, the only state to do a self-employment fund. So what we've been trying to do is not just cut taxes, but continue that momentum we've built of success where we keep sending the money, if you will, because it ain't my money. It ain't the government. It's your money. Right? And we really try to emphasize that this is your money. So you guys spend it. I want to create opportunity by sending it back to cities and towns, local businesses, whatever it is. So we're able to do that both in and outside of the pandemic, able to cut taxes. People said the interest, we had a 5% interest in dividends tax, I think for 40 years. My father was a former governor, as you know, and I won't lie to you, I made a few phone calls, and I've been rubbing it in his face that I'm the one that actually got rid of the interest in dividends tax. That'll be rolled back to zero in the next few years. So, but again, the revenues keep coming. Mm-hmm. We're now one of the fastest growing states in the country, the fastest in New England, which we're very proud of. So my goal in that isn't just to say thank you for the awards and the accolades, but hopefully show a model that works to other states. Right. I want to be a proof in the model. And I don't think necessarily, you know, Governor Baker, I think does a very good job in Massachusetts, given the political dynamics. Phil Scott, I think, does a very good job in Vermont, given the political dynamics he has to deal with over there. But hopefully we are a model of how to do things a little differently, not just to Republican, but maybe even some blue states as well. It works. We have the revenues coming in. You can cut taxes. Be a place people want to come to. And the most important part of that, it's sustainable, right? Mm-hmm. Those businesses are growing to be there, not just today and next year, but for 5, 10, 20 years down the road. And that's the most important thing I take home. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be governor forever. I trust me, just trying to go into a fourth term is hard enough. It strains on the family and all of that. But if I'm going to leave a legacy, I just want programs and things that we've done in a positive way to be sustainable and last, and not just because it keeps getting voted on, because it's working. It's a tangible working model that even the ultra left would have to say, well, let's not touch that. It works too well. Mm-hmm. That's always my goal.
Yeah, the best governors aren't the ones that build temples. It's the ones that give the most power back to people to make sure that they can have their own kind of live their own life well, right?
That's it.
That's, I think, what you're trying to do. But Jason?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to follow up on that and ask, what would you say are the main policy lessons for other governors? Mm. You know, how can they achieve good policy, and what does that good policy look like?
So we talked about, I won't harp on it too much, we talked about the economic freedom, and that starts with cutting taxes. Mm-hmm. You still have to create a system, you still need government systems, right? You can't be, I'm not with these anti-government, you know, anarchists. They're out there, let me tell you. But you still need government systems, because without the government system, you can't create the metrics of accountability or the standards you want to meet or the goals. Someone still has to be there to assess that, measure that, and challenge yourself to, hey, we tried five things, A, B, C, D, and E. A, B, and E worked. These two didn't. So let's pivot. So one of the goals I try to emphasize is, whatever you do, be flexible. Don't create a system that you have to be stuck with for 10 years. Create something that has flexibility. I'm an engineer by trade. I was a civil and environmental engineer for many years, and I cleaned up hazardous waste sites and all this sort of thing. But I always learned, you never design the system perfectly the first time. Mm-hmm. So you got to create flexibility in there so you can pivot, whether I'm here or not, and down the road. You know, from that comes other from that economic freedom comes other opportunities, like, believe it or not, school choice. Mm-hmm. It's very much attached to economic freedom. We passed school choice in New Hampshire. So how did we do that? We said, well, let's focus on those that need choice the most, lower income families. Mm-hmm. So families up to 300% of the federal poverty level can now use the state portion of their funds, whatever state money would normally go to educate that child in the school. That's your money. Mm-hmm. You decide where it can go. Whether it's a private school, homeschooling, tutoring, virtual learning academies online, whatever it is, right? The parent and the child knows the best path. Now, 98-99% of kids, public schools in New Hampshire, phenomenal. They're great. I'm the first governor in 25 years to come up through the public schools in New Hampshire. And let me tell you, they are phenomenal. But for 1 or 2% of the kids, sometimes those four walls of the traditional classroom don't work. So let's not just keep trying to cram it in. Because it can be miserable for those kids. It really can. Mm-hmm. And there's so much potential bottled up in those kids that never gets kind of brought to the surface. So let's let them design their path. So now these families have that kind of money. And that, in essence, is economic freedom. It's giving the money back to that family, saying, you design your own educational pathway. We thought, you know, a few hundred kids might take up the program in the first year. It's something like seven times what we expected, mm-hmm. which tells you the demand was there. And it's mostly, frankly, lower income, a lot of inner city families that school wasn't working for their kid, for their child, for whatever reason. And it's not for me to say that why it isn't working or whatever it is. It's me to say, I appreciate you don't think it's working. So here's the dollars. Mm-hmm. Here's all the other options. You do you. You find that best path for your child.
Yeah. Do you think that with the some of the issues with schooling and the pandemic, not to mention some of the aspects where we've seen the culture war come to the classroom, is this going to actually increase demand, do you think, in New Hampshire?
Without a doubt. Right? Oh,
so
yeah.
What might it look like over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think it increases demand all over the country, right? You're seeing it. I mean, you've seen some very successful school choice models. And every state's a little different. Arizona, Florida, West Virginia has a really powerful model moving forward. So every state's a little different, as it should be, because your city dynamics, your socioeconomic dynamics are a little different. Your accessibility, geographic accessibility to education is always a challenge. We have some rural parts of New Hampshire where folks would love another opportunity, but maybe a charter school isn't nearby, or there's not a private school within 40 miles, and transportation becomes an issue. So you have to look at those dynamics as well. But without a doubt, to your point, the pandemic, I think, really opened up a couple things. First, not to just bash on unions, but I try not to be a union basher, although I'm very pro right to work. The teachers union is out for the teachers union. I mean, even teachers are rebelling against the teachers union now. You're seeing that all across the country. They're out for their own interests, and that is a failing model. It's a failing model. You saw it really play out in Virginia, right, with Glenn Youngkin, who, by the way, huge fan of Glenn Youngkin. I think he's going to be a phenomenal governor. I think he gets inaugurated in the next couple of days. I think he's going to be great. But, you know, he won in Virginia not on some driven party platform stuff. He won because he simply said, parents matter, right? Mm-hmm. Parents matter. It's that simple. And let's champion that, because it's a model that has always worked. So whether a combination of what you saw with schools shutting down just in excessive amounts across the country, you know, we made sure our schools were going to be open. And we had a lot of superintendents call and say, you can't do this. You can't open up. You can't do it. And we said, no, we are opening those doors. It isn't about you. It is not about the system. It is about that child. at the end of the day. And I understand during the early days of the pandemic, things had to tighten up and close to figure out what was really going on. How serious was this? We had no resources, no PPE or like none of that existed. But then it was, okay, there's a lot of kids that might have fallen through the gaps here. I made sure the schools got open before the end of the year because I said, we have to assess these kids because it's about them. We have to get our eyes on them and see what's happening so that, again, when they have options or we have resources, we know where to put them in September. Let's not wait till September to figure out where we are and how's it going. We got to be way ahead of the game here. And in that sense, it really worked and it empowered parents to say, yes, we come first, my kids come first, not just the system. And for most kids, it was working fine. I mean, not remote. I mean, that worked didn't work very well for many people at all. But getting back in the classroom was a huge sigh of relief. But for some parents, they said, okay, let's take this opportunity and find another avenue. And we're just I think in New Hampshire, very progressive on online programs, VLACs, what we call our VLACs programs, charter schools. I'm very pro-charter school, very pro-other option, right? And homeschooling, great homeschooling program in New Hampshire. So we're able to open up those avenues. Our Commissioner of Education, I think, did a great job of really opening those doors, not for government, but for families and marketing that.
And educational freedom is a big part of freedom in the 50 states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So it did make national news when you decided to run for re-election as governor rather than run for the Senate. Mm-hmm. And so you must believe that there is some unfinished business, even in New Hampshire. Yeah. you mentioned sure. Right to work. I mean, what would you see as your agenda going forward?
So, you know, I really, it's a great question. We've got a lot done in terms of getting things moving forward with a whole new system. But you don't just set up the system and say, yep, there you go, we're good, right? You got to see it through. I'm a manager. I'm a CEO, if you will. I like to design these systems and see them through and know that there's going to be some kinks in the road. I think I understand the intent of what we've tried to do with a lot of these things. We rebuilt our whole new system for substance use disorder, right? Mm-hmm. New Hampshire was at the tip of the spear when it came to the opioid crisis. So it was politically challenging. But we did the right thing. We kind of broke down the old system, if you will. We rebuilt up a whole new system, bottom up, right? Kind of that local control, individual empowerment, bringing in a lot of private sector, not just dollars and resources, but assistance where the programs are driven by the private sector. For the last 2 years, we haven't seen an increase in overdose deaths. We're the only state in the country to do that. And so we're not done. You can't just rest on that. I think there's still a lot more work to do. Our numbers are still too high for me. So I want to see that through. School choice, just getting underway. Right. Still, maybe we could see some kinks in there. Maybe there's opportunity to grow it. So let's kind of see that all the way through. COVID is still very much with us. And I hope it's gone tomorrow. We all know it won't be. So if it is here for the long term, potentially, I want to make sure whatever we're doing is long term sustainable, which is why I stay away from, you know, mandates and shutdowns and all of that, because then it becomes like a light switch. And boy, the insecurity you build in the system, what you're doing to the citizens. We're in a state of emergency today. We have a mask order today. We're shutting down a bit. Stop it. Stop it. That is not sustainable. You got to build a long-term sustainable system. So I'd love to see Right to Work done. I'd love to expand a couple of the programs that I think we've gotten off the ground. You know, we have I passed a paid family leave program in New Hampshire. But here's the fundamental difference. It's your choice. It is not an income tax. It is not government driven. The government is not going to be the insurance company. It is pure choice. It is privatized and it brings in the private sector. Now, where they go nationally, I don't know. It's the only one of its kind in the country, and that's going to get underway. And if you want to buy into the system, great. If you don't, that's on you too. So from an individual standpoint, it doesn't drive cost or drive burden on that individual. So we try to empower that. Those are the types of programs that are very new. You don't see them anywhere else in the country, frankly. So I still think there's a year or two to make sure they get underway, they get nurtured the right way, so hopefully they're sustainable. And if they don't work, that's okay too. You own that and say, boy, we tried something. It didn't work. We're going to pull back on it. Politicians nowadays, they're so hesitant to admit that that they tried a bunch of things and something might not have worked. Right. What a shocker. Right. It's okay.
We do that in the private sector.
Right. Right. In the private sector, you want people to innovate, try things, and fail. It's okay to fail. It's actually an amazing opportunity sometimes in the private sector to learn from the failures. Government and politicians don't seem to have that mindset, and we're trying to bring that to the table.
Well, and the advantage of federalism, right, is that you don't have a countrywide failure when governors and legislators experiment.
That's it.
I mean, we saw what happened. I think Vermont tried to do a pretty socialistic healthcare reform that didn't work. well, thank goodness the whole country didn't have to suffer from that, right?
Right.
So that's one of the things we like about federalism. Yeah. And people can vote with their feet. You know, Jason mentioned earlier the how migration patterns relate to freedom. I mean, it's shocking. Even controlling for climate, people are moving to more free states, and people are fleeing the Illinois. And heck, how could you screw up California given the weather and the natural resources, but people want to leave places
Can we talk about California for a second?
Sure.
So I used to live there. I lived in San Francisco for 3 years. Any state would kill for their tourism, would kill for their ports, huge multi-billion dollar industry, kill for Hollywood and entertainment, their agriculture, right? They have it all, and boy, have they just thrown it away. I mean, all the opportunity in the world. They should be trying to get away from America because they're so rich and wealthy and attractive, you know? But it's just the opposite, and it's so sad because there's so much potential out there. And again, I don't bring that up so we can just rail on California because it has so much potential. I rail on it because I want people to understand policy matters. Mm-hmm. Who you elect matters. And I'm not even getting into the Republican-Democrat thing, but people that really understand how to capitalize on policy and believe in the individual, believe in that what you guys are espousing, that freedom that really defines the success of the state ultimately, and ultimately the success of the individual. Less burden, less worry on the individual.
Well, I like what you said about believing in people because New Hampshire doesn't have a seatbelt law. But does that mean that people all over New Hampshire are getting into car accidents and flying through their windshield?
No.
Why not?
We have a very good rate because, look, you talk about the importance of seatbelts. Mm-hmm. You talk about that it keeps you safer and all of that. And you talk about it's your responsibility to wear a helmet when you're riding a motorcycle. I mean, we don't have that law either because it's your personal responsibility. And the vast majority of people do.
Right.
So, again, it's okay. You have to believe in the individual. Too often big governments... their philosophy is, well, we don't believe in the individual. I've had extremely liberal, socialistic Democrats come up and tell me right to my face that, well, low-income families don't have the education to know what's best for their children. Mm-hmm. The offense of that statement is astounding. Mm-hmm. And I don't get offended that much. I'm a pretty positive person. But when I hear things like that, I think, my gosh, It's not my job per se, but I think it's all of our responsibilities to find folks to take leadership positions that understand the power of the individual, the importance of it, and believe in them. That's where the best ideas come from, right? And you got to open up your mindset to that as opposed to just politics or a political platform.
Yeah. Well, let me talk or ask you a little bit about the pandemic, because this is legitimately a tough issue. What do you do about a contagious disease that spreads from person to person while still respecting freedom as much as you can? You know, even people who believe in freedom have a lot of disagreements about that. You know, I came to here to D.C. with my wife, actually, and we were going to go to this restaurant that she liked, and we saw that, oh, actually, there's a vaccination mandate in restaurants here in D.C. I'm triple vaccinated, but I didn't think to bring my vaccine card. I'm just not used to that. And, you know, I sort of wonder, like, now that I'm confronted with it, it does seem a little invasive for government to mandate that everywhere throughout the entire city. So I'm just curious. I mean, how do you navigate that? You know, what sorts of policies do you see as going too far? What are the right policies for addressing the pandemic?
So one thing I always remind folks is you really have to separate 2020 from 2021. In that, in 2020, we didn't have a vaccine, we didn't have tools, we didn't have PPE, and that's why virtually every state went to some sort of let's take a pause on a lot of this. It was spreading like crazy, the elderly, the outbreaks, and virtually every state did. And then we started really opening things up and doing it in a way that, again, two things. Kept some guidelines on things such that the consumer and individuals felt safe and secure. But, you know, in New Hampshire, when we talked about regulations around businesses, how does that pertain to COVID or anything like that, with the restaurants, we brought the restaurant people in. They basically wrote their rules, and they worked with myself, my epidemiologist, and they designed it the way they wanted to design it. The bowling alleys designed their rules the way they wanted to design it. The salons designed the system the way they wanted to design it. And we'd tweak it here and there, but at the end of the day, because we let those individuals, those businesses have the right say, it gave everyone the confidence and everyone the comfort as we move forward, and that's why we've just been so flexible through it. Now, once the vaccine comes and the boosters or whatever you want to talk about, those are the tools where, again, as an individual, I now have the power to protect myself and my family. I have that individual power and responsibility. We're good. We're still managing the pandemic. There's still a crisis out there. It is not over. But from the government's perspective, we're not going, at least in New Hampshire, we're not going back to states of emergencies and, mm-hmm. and statewide mandates. If a business wants to require something, that's their right to do so. I believe that. Even if I don't agree with it, it's their right to do so. If a private hospital says, we're going to mandate a vaccine for, it's always been their right to do so, and I'm going to keep supporting that because that's their right. There's a couple other governors that didn't agree with me on that, but not many, but a few, because it's businesses do have rights. I've had people say, businesses don't have rights. Of course they do. Of course they have rights. They're private businesses. They're private entities. So I don't believe in government-driven mandates. They are doomed to fail, as we're seeing, right? Mm-hmm. We're fighting them in courts, obviously, but I can't tell you the number of not necessarily Republican or right-leaning business owners that have called me and say, how do I get out of this OSHA mandate? I'm going to lose auto dealers, for example. Right. They're going to lose their staff that work in the techs that work in their auto dealership are literally going to go across the street to the smaller guy,
right.
Have no better a safety risk in terms of COVID,
right.
And lose people that maybe have been working for that company for 20 years. Yeah. It's tearing families. It's tearing businesses apart, you know, these family businesses. My big thing is letting individuals and businesses decide how they're going to manage themselves. And and you have to stay consistent in that.
Right.
As much as I don't think there should be a government mandate forcing the vaccine, I also don't believe there should be a government mandate telling businesses they can't have a vaccine. If that restaurant wants to ask for a vaccine card, that's their business. I don't think the government should force it.
Yeah.
But that's their business. I might not agree with it. Right. But that's their business.
I mean, that seems to be the consistent freedom position.
I think
right?
so. Yeah.
You're respecting the rights of businesses. You're respecting the rights of individuals. You know, it makes total sense to me. But just for people online, just remember if you have questions, hashtag free states, regardless of what platform you're on. But if you're on the webpage, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and if you have questions, and you know, when you hopefully we'll have some people out there that jump in there and want to ask you. You know, give you some.
I can only imagine.
Give you a high and tight.
Pedro
Martinez.
I've done 150. You know, one thing early on in the pandemic is it's part of the whole freedom, part of making sure folks have a voice. I did press conferences and I would stand there until the press literally had no other questions. I've never walked out of a press conference when someone said, wait, we have another question. And I will stand there for as long as it takes because I never want someone to say we weren't super transparent about what we're doing. You know, in a crisis, transparency is the foundation of public trust. And so while you might not agree with a policy I'm giving or agree with an approach, because we were so transparent, people said, well, at least we know exactly where it's coming from and why. We might not agree here and there. And overall, that built a great sense of confidence for families so they could say, yeah, they have some guidelines. We can go out. It's very open in New Hampshire, but we know they're not just ignoring it, right? We can go out and we're going to be part of the community. And our economic success was phenomenal. And because we invested so much of the CARES Act into money into businesses or into individuals, again, that made sure that when the economic comeback of 21 came, we were already planning for it. We weren't kind of figuring it out into 120. We were coming out like a rocket ship. And I think that was what has driven a lot of our success. Families moving in, businesses growing like crazy. The one issue we have is housing, as we do all across the country.
Yeah.
Finding affordable housing. I be careful with the word affordable, the term affordable housing, workforce housing, whatever you want to call it. Look, I just want a teacher that works in a school to be able to rent an apartment.
Yeah.
And it's affordable. For the most part, but there's not a lot of available. And it's, if I may, it's one of the one, if you had to say, what's the one downside of local control? The one glaring negative has been housing, because on a permitting level, they can stop anything.
Right.
And multifamily housing has almost become a NIMBY issue, you know? I mean, they almost treat it like it's a prison or something. But so what we're trying to do is say to businesses, not the government, I don't believe the state government should come in and put their thumb down and say, you shall and you must. But entice businesses as some of the largest taxpayers maybe in their town to go in and say, we have a voice. You want this business to grow. We want to grow. But we can't do it without employees, and we can't have employees without housing. So empower them to be part of that solution, not just a government solution, but a community solution. And you know, if we need to incentivize that or create opportunities to open those doors, better education for those planning boards, whatever it takes. But housing is still one of the real issues that we're facing. I've learned subsequently most states are facing it.
So St. Anselm is actually a leader in research on on housing policy. So I wonder, Jason, if you could take a minute just to talk about some of the work that St. Anselm's is doing there, because I think it is relevant to this big issue.
Sure, and we've partnered with the governor and with the with Taylor Caswell in the Department of Economic Development, and other people in state government, the former Office of Strategic Initiatives, and what we've been trying to do is first do the research and figure out. What are the places that are actually really restricting housing and just trying to build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything,
Right.
and there are some of those places in New Hampshire and in other states as well. And so we're bringing those data so that we can then say, okay, well, what are the consequences of that? And we see the consequences are not much housing supply, very expensive housing, and lots of actually socioeconomic segregation, where the wealthy people live in Portsmouth and Hanover, and the working class people that come in to serve them live 30 minutes away in the cheap town or the cheaper town, and that's a somewhat unsustainable economic model, especially when you look at how it interacts with schools and the fact that. Access to the better public schools is being gated by housing, right? And that's a real barrier to social mobility. So we've looked at those consequences, and then we've also looked at potential solutions. And some of that may involve creative state policy, like the housing appeals board that you supported. Ways of not getting rid of local control, but actually just making it work better. So that more people in the community have a say, because what happens so often at these local hearings and at local elections is that the NIMBYs turn out, they show up, the abutters, whatever, they complain. But the majority of the community that supports these projects is unheard. And so if we can activate voices and make them more effective in the process, we'll get more secure property rights for property owners so that you can actually develop housing on your property. And that's going to have beneficial economic consequences.
Without a doubt. There are a couple small towns. The one I use a lot is Walpole. Beautiful, tiny town in the western part of the state. Very rural, very charming town. And there was an affordable housing project done in town. And it was done so well. It looks like a beautiful old barn. And they did it with the aesthetics of the town. And they matched it in. And they used sustainable materials and all this. They made all the right investments. They put it in the right location. And it isn't like... There are some folks that just, workforce housing, they think Section 8 housing of the 1970s, right? That's not what we're talking about here. So a lot of it is education about the benefits economically, the models that really do work. And not that every model works for every town, but that is one of the areas where I think the state can get involved, just to, on the education side, showing successful models, doing the tours. Come to this town. Let me show you what they did. And how it can be beneficial. And then again, I do believe having the business sector come in and say, look, we're growing like crazy. We're doing it right here in New Hampshire, but we can't do it without housing. You got to be part of that success. And usually the planning boards and everything will be a little more receptive to the local businesses as opposed to the government coming in and trying to put their thumb on things. So we still got a ways to go, but it's a challenge. But I think there's some solutions there.
Yeah. So I want to zoom out here from the small towns like Walpole or Sandwich or Berlin, right?
Walpole, Sandwich, and I don't know if I won those towns. Oh, in 2020 I did. I don't know.
Let's zoom out to kind of the bigger, broader questions. I mean, we're at the Cato Institute. This is a place that is a kind of beating hub of freedom talk. So what are the challenges?
I would love to hear what you guys say around the water cooler here. I want to know what the meeting, but this is great. This is great.
But what do you think are the big challenges to freedom? I mean, we've talked about how we define freedom there. It's a very American tradition. I think you hold that view. What are the biggest challenges to freedom, period, in this country that we need to wrestle with?
He said sitting in Washington, D.C.
Maybe it's to solve it at the state level, but still, what are the big challenges?
You know what? So I have two answers to that. One is going to be a little esoteric, but... obviously, one of the biggest challenges of freedom is that I think people have to understand that who you elect matters, policy matters, and policy has a direct impact on your family in a very day-to-day way. I'm afraid that we're not inspiring that next generation. I mean, I was talking to a congressman this morning about how do we get that next. I'm not saying even people that have to agree with me, but people that understand what's going on, that next generation of folks that do understand about individual liberty, individual responsibility, personal and economic freedom, and the models that drive to that. I'm afraid there are great people out there going, I'd love to run for office, but I'm not getting involved in that world. It's so ugly. It's so partisan. It's so negative. It's all personal. Mm-hmm. And I think as a system, as a government system, we're disenfranchising the next generation of leadership. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to keep going down this road that we're seeing today out of Washington, D.C., which is, it's scary. It's stuff that 10 years ago we never thought would be discussed. Most Democrats 10 years ago never thought certain things would be said on the floor of the Senate and the House that are being said today, right? That just completely infringe on freedom. One system, big government solutions that scare the heck out of us. The only good news is that Congress seems inability to do anything unless they try to go ultra authoritarian, like what you saw very recently with this idea. Well, we're going to nationalize your elections. Mm-hmm. we could go on all day about what a colossally bad idea that is. But in the mindset of some folks in Washington, a lot of them right now, that's the way to go. That authoritarian one-size-fits-all is a way to go because it fits their immediate need. It doesn't fit the American public's need, but it fits their immediate need to get other things passed and all that sort of stuff and really game the system. They believe in a big system because now they believe they can game it to their... I think the other, if you will, existential threat to freedom, I don't want to blame social media, but I'll just say it's our cultural attitude right now in that I have kids. I have two in high school. Mm-hmm. I have two high schools. I have a third grader. And I get concerned that they've grown up in over the last 10 years only seeing the fight, the negative, the anger, the fear. Mm-hmm. I try to stay very positive, and it's not on accident. It's very intentional. You need positivity. You need to believe in something. You need hope. And we have a generation now that, aside from politics, although that seems to integrate with everything, that it's all about the fight. Mm-hmm. And we need to culturally change that. Now, it's spawned because, look, I think social media can be a great thing, but it is a technology that we are not mature enough to handle as humans right now, right? It was too good and too fast for us to handle responsibly. And we're seeing the negative outcomes of that. And it got compounded by the COVID crisis when folks got even more remote and even more separated. We think we're being social on social media, but it's one of the least friendly. It's like, do you ever live in New York City? Walk around New York City. You're surrounded by 10 million people, and it's the loneliest place on earth. You think you're in a community. You think you're being social. I'm out with all these people. That's exactly what social media is. You're not being social and connected, really connected with anybody, but you're part of a community without connection. That connection drives open ideas, positive discussion, understanding that individual has a voice, and it matters, and it's smart, and so let's empower it. When there's less connection, there's more of an adhere to a bigger government system. And so that fundamentally is in itself a threat to freedom because disconnection pushes us back to more systems. And more systems is the antithesis of believing in the individual and local control.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's great.
Can someone write that down? I feel like that was very profound.
It's on tape.
So you mentioned here that and in your public comments, you've been consistently pretty critical of the way D.C. does business. You know, the federal government
doesn't do any business.
Yeah. Well, why is it? Do you think that that the states have been so much more innovative lately than the federal government have been much more flexible?
We have to be. As governors, we're held to a standard of accountability. Mm-hmm. We're much more connected to citizens. It's so easy. Even good Republican, freedom-minded individuals come to Washington, and I don't know what it is in the air here, but they get Washingtonized. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to go along and not stay connected with your citizens, hear their voice, give it value, give it appreciation, and still get caught in the Washington discussion. Turn on C-SPAN right now. God knows what they're talking about, but it ain't anything that's going to truly affect your lives, other than maybe this election stuff. But there's so little of it is impactful because they won't balance a budget. You have Social Security that's going to go bankrupt. You have Medicare that they don't want to touch any of it. Even Republicans don't want to touch any of it. And it was that attitude where I said, "Look, I'm going to drive you guys crazy because I demand if I'm going to put my family through the public scrutiny of being in a public life." By God, I'm going to get something done, and it's going to be something with a positive impact for my citizens. As governor, I can get in the car and I visit a business, I visit a school. Every day we're doing it. What's happening? And we're talking, but we're listening to. And if I hear what your questions and your fears and your concerns are, then as an elected official, I can help empathize with what's going on there. And that empathetic connection
is what I then can take back to Concord and say, guys, these are real issues hitting these families. School choice is real. Mm-hmm. I have low-income families, minority families that feel absolutely trapped, right? You know, let's make sure that they are first in line at the trough for the economic opportunity of education, of educational freedom. You drive that. And then when the model comes forward, you have accountability. You're checking on it. You're working with it. You're visiting those families. What's working? What is awesome.
I love it. There's no sense of that here. I'm sorry. There isn't.
And that's a frustration. Someone said to me,
yeah, I'm one of the only two governors in the country that has to get elected every 2 years. And I'm running for now a fourth term, but I've been governor just about 5 years now. And someone said, well, won't it be great? You don't have to get elected only once every 6 years. I said, what a nightmare. Because if I don't like it after the first year, I'm trapped.
These guys don't feel trapped. That shocks me, right? So they
do nothing for year after year, and they kind of get okay with it. So I don't mean this to be a complete dig in rag, but ultimately that's that. And you see a lot of, I think, great potential leaders saying, I'm not running for the Senate. I'm a governor.
I'm a local community leader.
I have impact, and I can see in someone's eyes what I've done to help their family.
I can see that family who did get services for their daughter who had overdosed twice, but now under this new system,
She's there, and there's continual supports, and she has self-worth and all of this sort of thing.
Behavioral health, which is the next,
which is really the real crisis of America, by the way, which folks don't want to talk about or touch. But you have to engage in the behavioral health issue
and mental health issues, especially around kids. Create ways for parents to get those supports instead of the old. I mean, we shamed people for behavioral health issues, and it was just that stigma was just the opposite. You can engage with the family,
and you talk to a mom or a dad, and you see that they're finally getting supports that they didn't get before. Not because you put more money in the system, you just opened more doors. You created a more open system. It's awesome. And so that's a hard thing as a governor to walk away from. I'm not term limited, although I'm not going to do this forever. A very different philosophy here. So I apologize to the 535 people I just insulted over on Capitol Hill. But you got to get stuff done. And I'm a big believer if they said, we're going to take it on the chin politically, but we're going to actually balance the budget.
What a novel concept. But they treat it like it's
the third rail.
Just the opposite. If they have the guts to stand up and balance the budget
the right way
in a bipartisan way, America would stand up and say thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for making sure my kids aren't burdened with $35 trillion in debt or
where it's going to go to.
You know, people will, even though they have to make certain sacrifices here and there, they will get behind results in leadership. And so I get back to the question you asked earlier. I want to inspire that in that next generation of leaders. I'm not going to be doing this forever. And so who's the next generation to step up and look at these
models with an open,
positive mind, not just get sucked into a Washington or social media
vortex.
And say, look, this matters. I mean, this stuff is
real. These rankings are real. They matter. And this is where folks are going. These are where people are flocking to. Texas, Florida, Tennessee, New Hampshire, Idaho. Right. These are red states. I'm just guessing very high up in a lot of the economic freedom categories that you have listed here, and that economic success
for those states is less burden on an individual.
My job is to make sure someone wakes up and has one less thing to worry about today, right? Not because the government says so,
but because another door
of opportunity opened up, and it's one less thing they have to
change. Yeah, they're protecting the government is protecting your life and your liberty. But otherwise, it's letting you kind of live your life project, right?
You do.
Right, exactly.
And look, I'm more socially moderate, right? I'm not a social conservative by any means because it ain't my business. Right. That's not why I got into this game. On a variety of different levels, you do you.
Mm-hmm. But I am guessing that you think that there's probably a moral ecology that is helpful to be a foundation for freedom. I mean, I think about a place like New Hampshire. You talked about earlier about the kind of Puritan foundations, you know, personal responsibility, kind of Yankee thriftiness. Aren't these key parts of a successful free society too?
I'm going to name my state of the state Yankee thriftiness.
No, but in government, but also in your personal life,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, I have to balance my checkbook. Mm-hmm. I have to pay my mortgage every month. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't the government? It's really just that simple, right? Mm-hmm. Now, can you know? I just go out and buy whatever I want. No, I have to make sacrifices. I can't get everything I want. There are folks in that run for office with the idea. Oh, hi. There's folks that run for office with the idea that, well, there's plenty of government money. My job is just to, you know, spend more of it and put it into my programs, as opposed to saying, look, we got to create these opportunities at an individual level, open those doors. And if it means, you know, when you go through a budget process, sometimes you'll find a position that's been allocated in the government that hasn't been filled for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so you say, well, we're doing pretty well. Do we really need that on the books? You haven't been able to hire someone, obviously not top priority. Let's get it off the books, right? And so, you know, going through, I early on, I wiped out something like 1,500 rules and regulations with an executive order because they were redundant. They were silly, frankly. And we kind of started a good momentum in that over the past 5 years about making sure that we can keep bringing down rules and regulations. Someone can always justify a rule and a regulation, right? Mm-hmm. I could come up with almost any rule that fits a certain specific niche, but you have to take the time to say, but that had a negative effect in all these other areas. Mm-hmm. So let's bring it back. What's the net good here? Oh, the net good is to get rid of that rule or to adjust it some way. And you have to have the ability to do that. But so often laws and rules are put into place for a specific instance that elected official has found in their community. They're trying to do the right thing for their community. But if it's having a negative impact, that's where the governor comes in and says, as a whole, our state is being drawn down by this. Mm-hmm. And so let's clean it up. And I'd rather whiteboard something and build it back up. I'd rather go to the extreme the other way of whiteboarding it and getting rid of a few too many regulations and forcing it to be rebuilt, as opposed to just piling on and piling on.
So do we have a question from our audience online here?
We've got a large number of questions from online. Okay. Let's start with a question from Rob over in Dover. Rob specifically asks to the governor, in your opinion, what extent is the institution of the Executive Council, which is admittedly a very interesting institution, could you explain it a little bit, but what role do you think it plays in supporting the New Hampshire Advantage?
The Executive Council is one of the most challenging things I have to deal with as governor, and it's awesome. And this is why. It's a pure checks and balance on the power of the governor, and that is a win for the citizens of the state. It's a vestige. At one time, all the colonies had Executive Council. Ours is from 1679 or 1680. Oh. Mm-hmm. King George I put it in because his idea was he didn't want, at the time called presidents of the colonies, to have too much power. Mm-hmm. So they basically had to get authority, not on laws, but authority on rules and contracts and how they spent money to go through a five-person council. I was a member of the council for a little while. And it really is a checks and balance in a couple areas. New Hampshire is the only state to really have one left that does anything. I think Massachusetts has one that approves judges or something. But any contract above, I think, $25,000 in the state comes to an open and public meeting every other Wednesday that anyone can come to, and we debate, and the counselors and the commissioners and the governor debate those contracts, every single one. Mm. It's an amazing transparency in government, and it ensures a couple things. Number one, there's not, I'll use the technical term, fiscal shenanigans in New Hampshire. It has to be bid out. It has to be an open process. If there's any questions, you can ask questions, or the counselors can ask the commissioners any questions. Also, every nomination I make, from the Board of Housing, the Board of Medical Supervisors, to the Supreme Court Justice, all I need three votes. Of the five counselors, I need three votes. So those are the two most important areas where they provide a check on the governor. It can be frustrating, of course. Sometimes they're Republican. Sometimes they lean Democrat. I've had both in my tenure. And you still get it done. And it really ensures that you're putting the best people forward. It ensures that you're putting the best contracts, the best open process for contracts forward. So, we don't agree all the time, but it really is. I wish, I tell you what, I think Washington needs an executive council. Just as it's not a political entity, but it's a check and balance on the individual to make sure nothing gets too out of hand.
Nice. We've got an additional question from another New Hampshire resident asking, Governor, you said some nice things to say about your neighbors to the south in Charlie Baker, Massachusetts, but can you give folks an update about the lawsuit going on between New Hampshire and Massachusetts about taxation and remote workers?
Yeah, I didn't agree with Charlie on that one. I remember the day I called him and said, I'm going to sue you. So because of workers, the background on this is because a lot of folks live in New Hampshire. They were working in Mass. They go remote during the pandemic. Now, they've been in New Hampshire for months and months and sometimes the entire year, yet they're still paying a Massachusetts income tax, which makes absolutely no sense. It's a true violation of the Constitution in that they're using absolutely no services of that state other than basically working for a company there, as many people do, and they have to pay an income tax. So we had a lot of states join us in that, because while we have no income tax at all, what we realized, you had like New York and New Jersey and Pennsylvania, you know, they all have income taxes, but they want their share, right? Mm-hmm. So they're kind of battling it out. We brought it to the U.S. Supreme Court.
When the Biden administration came in, their Solicitor General, I believe, intervened and gave an opinion that the Supreme Court probably shouldn't even hear the case. And so they didn't hear the case. Mm-hmm. So we're likely going to bring it back more with, not from the state's perspective, but from the individual, because individuals truly have standing. They're the ones that have really lost here. And hopefully bring it back and get the Supreme Court to hear it. So right now we haven't made, we lost the first round, but I'm not giving up the fight.
Across the over 200 metrics that's discussed in Freedom in the 50 states, one of which specifically cannabis freedom. Where do you, Governor, sit on that? That wasn't necessarily discussed in the Q&A, but sure. Where do you stand there?
So when I became governor, we decriminalized, right? We the previous governors wouldn't even decriminalize it, and I thought that was outrageous. So we came in, we decriminalized cannabis, we expanded its ability to be used for medical use, we expanded its ability for everything from veterans and a lot of other... Oh, you don't need that anymore? Okay. A lot of the other ability there. We still have not gone fully with a full legalization recreation. I've always said now's not the time. And the question is now the time? Are we getting there? I blew up the whole SUD treatment and recovery system and rebuilt something we call the doorway.
It's working phenomenally well. Again, the only state in the country where drug overdoses and deaths haven't gone up 2 years in a row.
So we're still not quite there. I mean, those numbers are still too high and still too high for my liking. But the question is, can we do it responsibly? And one thing that we're trying to do is learn from other states. So
virtually every other state around us has done it. Their drug problems are getting much more severe than ours is at this time. But we're trying to learn what worked in those states and what didn't. Where's the accountability there? Did this piece work? Did that piece not work? And we're back.
Did this piece work? Did that piece not work? And so I know there's a couple bills moving through the legislature. I think the bills that are there, if it were to be legalized, are actually a pretty good system, you know, from a state perspective, still no taxation on it or anything like that. But I got to tell you, what we've been doing the past couple of years is really working in terms of the opioid epidemic. So we're trying to get data and really understand, are we going to kind of go backwards like a lot of these other states have in terms of how we deal with the drug crisis? Or is now the right time? Can we have the right system that still enforces a lot of the prevention methods, keeps it out of the hands of kids, and all of that.
Yeah, and I mean, even if it's legalized, you know, that doesn't mean that the state is saying it's a good thing to do. Smoking cigarettes is legal, but I'm not a big fan of people who do it. Again, I want them to be free to do so, but we don't have to say, if you legalize, that means that the governor or the state is necessarily saying, okay, now we're blessing it.
We have the New Hampshire runs 75 liquor stores, right? And we're really good at it, by the way. And we have the best liquor stores and the lowest cost.
Big ones.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's an area where people say, well, how free can New Hampshire be if they're running a business like running liquor stores? And it's a very good point. But if you look at it from an economic freedom perspective, we customer service perspective, right? I'll put our product against anybody's. Lower cost. No tax. People are coming all over the place, all across the Northeast, to buy our product in our stores because the state runs it so well. And we let it run as a business. We really do. We let the commission kind of run as a business, as it should, at a very, I think, a very high quality. I know it's still a little bit contentious, but that model works. And if it didn't, we'd make changes. But for the consumer, which is the most important thing, for the individual, it creates a ton of opportunity. That's not saying that, you know, even though we have liquor stores on our highways, you should buy liquor and drink, right, you know, while you drink and drive. Obviously, that is something that you shouldn't do. But yeah, to your point, it doesn't necessarily endorse it. So I'm not sure where that will go. I just think our system, our drug prevention system and treatment system is working very well. It's getting a lot of success. We got to make sure it's the right time. And that still remains to be seen.
So we'll conclude our discussion today with a final question that seems almost a cry for help. From a resident of one of our bottom five states, and this is to each member of our panel, obviously, including the governor. We'll start with you. Outside of moving to New Hampshire, which this commenter says you've made a very compelling argument about, what can people in the bottom five states do to promote freedom in their state?
Run for office. And I really mean that very sincerely. The hardest thing to do about running for office is telling yourself, I'm going to do this. But then you do it, and you get in, and you engage with people. And I tell you, just looking someone in the eye, and it sounds, we have the first in the nation primary for a reason. Because it doesn't matter how much money you have.
we go door to door, we talk person to person, and we believe in the individual. It really gets back to this whole freedom concept. And so the individual has to believe in us. Even before we get to policy, they want to look you in the eye and say, okay, I've met this guy, I've met this woman, you know, this is somebody that, well, I might not agree on every point, but boy, they knocked on my door, they came to my place of business, they want to work hard for my community. That's what we want in leadership. They want to get stuff done.
Yeah.
And that's fundamentally a working model, and it's why we have such high voter turnout, local control, and our elections run so well. In these other states, you have to believe in that model. They'll tell you it doesn't work, but I'm telling you it does. And you have to believe in those individuals and take what we're talking about here and champion those types of ideals, because it's what everybody wants. They just haven't had many people come in California and New York. Very few people are actually offering that and showing a model that works in the understanding. And if that doesn't work, you grab my cell number and I'll find up your place in New Hampshire. You can come here anytime. So,
I mean, that's a great answer. Yeah. But for me, I would add to is K through 12 education reform, because I think we need to have big structural changes to how we do certain things in our country that have long run effects. And if we have a K through 12 system that isn't meeting parents and caregivers' needs, kids' needs, then it's not going to be one that's going to be successful for us as a country. But it's also because I think that if you have a monopoly government system like that, where you don't have, say, backpack funding, where the money goes with the student, you're not going to get a lot of those competitive juices, but you're also going to empower teachers' unions and others who want to, in many cases, force an anti-freedom agenda in the schools. Mm-hmm. You know, and I sent my kids to public schools for most of their time until recently, and there are lots of reasons why we decided not to do that, but one of them is that they weren't teaching a lot of the things that I thought was fundamental for them being a good citizen, but also being a free men, to grow up to be free men. I have two boys. And I think that when it comes to girls and boys, they need to learn some of those things. And unfortunately, that wasn't happening. And I think to have the choice to go to a lot of different types of schools that would offer a lot of different types of curricula that will meet their needs is going to be important, but especially because I think we need to have a break on a system that seems in many cases not to be trying to transmit the wisdom of our country's past going forward. And I think that that would support the kind of freedom that we believe in.
Yeah. And I would say getting involved in politics as a candidate or an activist for liberty is laudable. But let's say that that's not you, or maybe you think that there's no way that's going to work where you are. Maybe the political scene is just that bad. The other way you can promote freedom is actually by entrepreneurship and growing the economy. You know, I actually see that as effectively increasing the scope of freedom. And one example I'll give is, you know, a lot of cities used to have, most of them had sort of taxi cartels, right, where the government regulations prohibited competition among taxi companies. And then Uber comes in, and all of a sudden there's this route around that, and it vastly improved the quality and affordability of transportation within cities. And so that's just one example of how innovation can actually create freedom without changing any laws. And so if that's something that is more your skill set, you can create more freedom for everyone in the world by innovating.
Well, one thing I just add is don't become a grassroots tyrant. Right. Don't become the kind of person who says, I don't like X, therefore I'm going to lobby the governor and the government to try to restrict X and restrict other people's freedoms. Be the kind of person that says, like, I want to grow freedom, but I'm going to try to educate people about living a life that I think is a good one. Right. So if you don't think smoking is a good idea, don't ban it, but maybe try to convince, you know, your mom or dad or your cousin or your neighbor, like, hey, you know, have you noticed seems like this is kind of leading to bad things in your life.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of thing at your church or at other social function, right? But don't become the kind of person that tries to restrict freedom. And again, it doesn't mean that government doesn't have a role. I'm not an anarchist. I think government has an important role to protect properties. But I think we probably all agree that one thing we don't lack for in this country right now, unfortunately, are people trying to tell other people how to live their lives beyond the kind of core functions of government.
Absolutely. No, that's a great point. It hits home, not to come back to COVID, because everything seems to come back to COVID. But that's the vaccine discussion we're having, right? I don't believe in government mandates. I don't believe in government should be mandating the vaccine. But I firmly also don't believe, as we never have, we shouldn't be telling a business how to run their business. Fred's Flower Shop in New Hampshire.
family business. He's immunocompromised. He has a couple family members that have issues, and he has two local people that work for him. And he said, look, I just want to make sure everyone gets vaccinated here. Mm-hmm. That's his, it's his business. Yeah, it's his right to do that. Who am I to tell him he can't do that, right? And sorry, you have to say, you have to hire these people. When you open that door, understand what that means. You've now set a precedent for the next administration, Republican or Democrat, to say who a business can hire and fire and why.
Yeah.
Right. We've really don't let COVID, don't let the emergence of this pandemic, this moment in time, if you will, reset all new rules, whether it's I don't like something, so I'm going to shut it down for everybody, or I don't agree with something, so the government is going to solve it. That's a very un-Republican, libertarian philosophy.
But un-American philosophy.
Un-American philosophy. And I was I called some of my fellow Republicans in New Hampshire communists for even proposing that, frankly. Because it really is a very un-American thing. I might not like the results, right? You know, we individuals might not like the result, but it's their right to do that. And and again, the government just has to do what we've always done: stay out of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you everyone online for watching, but also thank you for the governor. It was a great discussion. Oh, I loved hearing you say all these.
Can't wait to see what the ratings are.
it'll be fantastic.
I really do appreciate it. And look, it's obviously an honor not just to be here with you guys. I mean, we have two of the big best minds in terms of economic freedom, individual freedoms, kind of that lowercase L libertarian thought of individuals have to come first. It's an absolute honor to be here and an honor to be ranked so highly. I can't wait to go through 230 different metrics here. I don't think we were number one in every one of them, but overall we were number one. And again, you know, I'm very proud to have been the most fiscally responsible governor and now the freest state and all of that. But at the end of the day, you know, being ranked the best is great, but there's always more work to do, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I said to you before, I said, I can't wait to go through this book and see where we didn't do well. Mm-hmm. And now let's challenge ourselves to take those on too. So there's always, accolades are nice, but at the end of the day, a trophy on the shelf is just something sitting on the shelf. Let's get to work and keep getting it done. So thank you guys for kind of driving that model, not obviously in New Hampshire, but nationally. You know, that national voice, it's so important. It really is.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.